you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle this week. Thanks for being with us. We have many movies to discuss, and coming up later in the hour, I talk with Jonna McLeod. He directed the new documentary, My Old School. Our conversation is coming up, so stick around for that. But first, we kick off with the new releases of the week. Critics joining me today are Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast Unspooled, and Claudia Puig, president of the LA Film Critics Association. Our animation authority, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, is also with us. Thank you all for being with me. Let's start with Vengeance. It's a comedy thriller starring BJ Novak, Issa Rae, and Ashton Kutcher. The film is written and directed by BJ Novak, who makes his feature directorial debut. Amy, why don't you get us going?
BJ Novak also stars in this movie. He plays this aspiring podcaster named Ben. And Ben writes for The New Yorker, but he, of course, is like a young guy. He wants to build his own brand and figure out who he is on this earth besides his main hobby, which is just like hooking up with tons and tons of girls with his buddy John Mayer, who is played by the actual rock star John Mayer. And I think doing a pretty good job of playing like the tabloid description of himself. The story gets going when Ben gets this call one night from the brother of a hookup that he has in his phone. He hears that this ex of his, ex is almost a strong word for it, has gone back home to rural Texas and she's died. And he doesn't really even know that much about this girl. But he gets his arm twisted to go back home to Texas to go to this funeral where he hears from her family that he was like the love of her life, that they had this special connection, that he was her boyfriend. And he decides that like this girl's death might make a really great podcast about rural America.
Of course. Exactly. Everything is a podcast.
Everything is a podcast. And you know, his producer Issa Rae gives it even like the ultimate podcast name. It's going to be called Dead White Girl. And so, yeah. So this is a kind of movie where, you know, the sense of humor, that actually sounds more satirical than it is. This movie is more earnest in its kind of humor. But, like, it is a story about this podcaster showing up in rural Texas and thinking of this bereaved family just as characters. And kind of the film's pattern is that, you know, it sets up this caricature of a Texan, and then it knocks down the caricature, and they're, like, smarter than you think. And it feels like BJ is using this film to kind of ruminate on all of these things that he wants to express about like America and thoughts and creativity and inspiration. And it's an interesting little film. Like, I found it a hard film to trust kind of in execution wise. Like, I never really relaxed into this film and felt like I was in competent hands. It looks a little bit cheap, and I'm still sort of debating over whether or not Novak is giving like a strong performance as a callow person, or if it's a callow performance that happens to fit the character really well. But I also don't know if that matters, because there's a lot in this film that I admired. I thought like actually the script writing was pretty good, even if I'm not quite sure I buy anything it says about how podcasting works.
Well, let me just say, if every aspiring podcaster in America goes to see this film, it'll be a bigger hit than Top Gun Maverick. Claudia, your thoughts?
I am addicted to podcasts. I would totally listen to Dead White Girl. You know, it sort of reminded me of S Town. The you know, Desire is like S Town, or like, you know, it has the This American Life kind of vibe. This is an interesting little film. I agree with Amy. It is competent. I admired the writing. I found it enjoyable. It's a smart dark comedy. It has a little neo-noir thriller about it. It's also kind of has that look at our cultural assumptions about, you know, New York versus Texas, the political divide in the U.S., the opioid crisis, the prevalence of guns. Like, it tries to take on a lot. And I think it marks a pretty assured debut for BJ Novak. And I enjoyed it. I kind of was a little hesitant too. I found his caustic humor sometimes, as you know, some of the stuff was pretty obvious that he was joking about. There's an opening scene with John Mayer and him, which I really love, though. They're at this party. I think they're like on a rooftop, and they're sort of philosophizing about women and why committed relationships don't work. And each one of them says something, and the other one responds with 100%. And they literally agree with each other's statements. And we all know how 100% is so widely spoken. And there's even like a line, like, it's a world of infinite possibilities, 100%, which kind of seems to contradict what it's saying. But we know these guys. And I liked that aspect of it. There was Issa Rae is got a really good supporting role. She is sort of she's in charge of the podcast. Ashton Kutcher has a really annoying role as a music producer. He sermonizes about life in grating ways. Anyway, the less said about that, the better. I kind of liked the concept that this is a self-absorbed guy who thinks he's going to figure it all out, and he realizes how empty he is. He literally says that. I thought it was nicely paced, intermittently funny, and entertaining overall.
100% is so 2021. I think it's 1,000%, at least according to my kids now. Vengeance from writer-director BJ Novak is rated R, and it's in wide release. Next up, Sharp Stick. It's a comedy. It's written and directed by Lena Dunham. It stars Christine Froseth and John Bernthal. Amy, what do you think of Sharp Stick?
I have seen this movie twice now, and I am still chewing on it, in part because it feels like it is two movies in one. One part of it, the first part of it, is Lena Dunham's attempt to make like this throwback style sexual satire about this innocent beauty who kind of wanders through the world filling men with desire, you know, kind of like Candy back in the 1960s, or like 900 different Polish and Swedish and Italian movies that are all filmed in that kind of fuzzy softcore lighting. That is the good part of this movie, where we get introduced to this like stunningly beautiful, stunningly innocent 26-year-old virgin babysitter. Her name is Sarah Jo. She dresses in these little modest floral dresses and knee socks, and she decides that she needs to get experience with men. And her target is the dad of one of the kids that she's babysitting, and it's this married guy who's a real doofus, played by John Bernthal, who, you know, any grown person with any life experience knows this guy is definitely bad news. But one of Dunham's skills that I think goes all the way back to Girls is she is so good at, like, casting and writing guys that you know are going to break your heart, but you just go for it anyway. You know what I mean? She's the person who put Adam Driver on the map. And so John Bernthal here is just wonderful. And she casts herself as his wife, as this character that is really written to be in sharp contrast to this like innocent, wholly imaginary penthouse letter type beauty that's like competing for his affection. You know, Dunham's character, this wife, is like a real woman, and she can be like needy and cranky and short-tempered, and she has standards in what she expects from men. And this love triangle between like a fantasy woman, a real woman, and John Bernthal, who is not worth any of this attention, to me is like the most interesting part of the movie. And the second half becomes this more realistic coming-of-age story that I don't think works very well. But the lead actress, Christine Froseth, she really goes for it. And there's also these great small performances from Jennifer Jason Leigh and Taylor Page. They play her mom and her sister. Like, Jennifer Jason Leigh is this ex-Duran Duran video starlet with like 5 divorces under her belt. Taylor Page is a wannabe Instagram influencer. They're just these like boy crazy rampaging maniacs who give Sarah Jo the absolute worst advice. And she takes it very literally. And all of those scenes are just magical. I adored them.
Claudia, what are your thoughts on Sharp Stick?
Well, I know I couldn't see this movie twice. I just couldn't do that. I wasn't a fan. This is Lena Dunham's first film in a decade. I loved her filmmaking debut, Tiny Furniture, back in 2010. This one feels aimless and messy to me. It feels like a collection of interesting ideas that don't really cohere into a compelling movie. It feels kind of chaotic and rambling, but it's the first half has definitely some power to it, and then the second half just kind of devolves, I think. And I did think it was well acted, definitely by Kristen Froseth and John Bernthal. I thought Jennifer Jason Leigh was kind of the, not the perfect mom, but she was an interesting character. But I feel like Lena Dunham enjoys making her audience uncomfortable. And I don't think it's a filmmaker's responsibility to comfort, but I don't know that I necessarily see a point in making an audience uncomfortable just for the sake of it.
Sharp Stick is playing at the Landmark New Art Theater in Sawtelle and multiple Lemley theaters. It will be available on digital and video on demand platforms starting August 5th. The film is rated R. Next up, the documentary My Old School. It comes from writer and director Jonna McLeod, who I talked to later in the hour. It features her stars, Alan Cumming, Claire Grogan, and the Scottish singer Lulu. I think, Claudia, can you explain what we're after here?
Yes, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. It's a documentary with lots of twists and turns and quite a bit of wit. But when you say it features Alan Cumming, so the storyline here is, this is about, I'll explain where Alan Cumming comes in. So the story is about a series of events that happened in 1993 when this new student came to this upscale high school in Glasgow called Bearsden Academy. He wins over a few of his fellow students. His name is Brandon Lee, not to be confused with the son of Bruce Lee. And he's from Canada. And what follows is this deconstruction of who Brandon Lee really was and what his motives were. And so because the real Brandon Lee declined to be on camera, declined to have his face shown, but did allow his voice to be used, Alan Cumming essentially plays the visual aspect of him. And he lip syncs all the commentary that Brandon Lee is giving. So it's kind of appropriate too, because Alan Cumming is obviously Scottish, and he was, I think I heard that he was going to play Brandon in a film that never happened.
You should listen to my interview in a little bit. You'll find the answer to that question.
Good. I look forward to it. So he serves as the stand-in for the guy, and that's a pretty brilliant workaround. And because Cumming is of course such a good actor, he lip syncs his voice seamlessly. He plays a lot of, he kind of downplays his character, and he disappears into the role really well. And it's just, I loved the fact that these outlandish events that were described, some of them were interspersed with animated sequences to illustrate them in sort of the popular style of animation of the time, like Daria. It just, so many documentaries are using animation these days to illustrate things that maybe can't be portrayed on camera, they weren't captured at the time on camera. And sometimes the use of animation in documentaries is brilliant, such as in Flea, which was nominated this year for Best International Film, Best Documentary, Best Animated Feature. But sometimes it's bordering on overuse. But I think in this case here, it really makes a lot of sense for the stylized sequences that are clever. I wasn't familiar with the actual news story, and part of me, when I first sat down to watch it, wanted to Google the real story, but I refrained. I urge everyone else to refrain. Do not Google it. Just sit and let it wash over you, because it's very entertaining. It's a really lively documentary. It chronicles this outlandish story. It unfolds really well. It's well paced. There's all these surprises and twists and turns, and ultimately it leads to something thought-provoking and compassionate. It's about memory, it's about perception, it's about education. And I understand, I'm sure we'll find this out with your interview, John, that Jonah McLeod went to the same school and knew some of these subjects that are interviewed, which
classmate of Brandon Lee.
Okay.
Has a high school reunion of sorts where he talks to his other classmates about Brandon Lee. Charles, what were your thoughts?
Claudia liked this better than I did. I agree that the use of animation in documentaries has become very interesting. And even ignoring the limits of these visuals, I think they're used very repetitively. One of the talking heads of the former classmates will say, "Oh, well, I'd go knock on his door." Cut to not very good animation of someone knocking on the door. Then we'd go and ride in his car with the windows down and play music. Cut to image of the, it duplicates what we've already been told. Often, I think, unnecessarily. You could have the talking head saying something, you could use the talking head's voice as a voiceover for the visual, but to keep going back and forth and back and forth like that is repetitious. What I found very disturbing about this is that there seemed to have been no consequences, that at one point, Brandon Lee, who was in, it was about 30, somehow went on an unchaperoned, unsupervised trip to Tenerife in Spain with four underage girls. Why does that have no consequence? And why didn't he get busted for having two passports under different names, which I believe is illegal in the UK?
It's probably illegal in most countries.
I was not as enchanted with it as Claudia was. I think it's an interesting story. And I also find it odd that they used Alan Cumming, who is very good, for that lip sync. But then you see the real Brandon Lee in quite a lot of old video footage and in various news shows being interviewed. So what he looks like is no secret. and he sure didn't look 16 to me.
My Old School is showing at the Lemley Monica Film Center in Santa Monica and Lemley NoHo in North Hollywood, and it's unrated. You'll want to stick around for my conversation with writer-director Jonna McLeod. That's coming up later in the hour. When we come back, more with our film critics. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. Stay with us.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on KPCC. Welcome back. I'm John Horn, subbing in for Larry Mantle this week. Let's jump right back to our reviews. We're discussing the biggest releases of the week. Now, the comedy drama Not Okay. It stars Zoe Deutsch and Mia Isaac. It's written and directed by Quinn Shepherd. Amy.
Yeah, this is our second film of the week about an aspiring young journalist who has dubious ethics and principles, we can say. This one actually opens with a tongue-in-cheek trigger warning about having a very unlikable protagonist. And our unlikable protagonist this time is Zoe Deutsch. She's this young, shallow New York journalist. She really wants to be the next Gloria Steinem, which you can tell because she has like the blonde streaks in her hair. She has the big sunglasses. She wears the kind of pants. She has absolutely nothing to write about, though. And nobody is taking her seriously at her magazine until she gets trapped in this social media lie that results in her telling everybody that she is the survivor of a deadly bomb attack that just happened in Paris. And everyone's like, oh my God, please write about this. So she does, and the think piece that she writes about dealing with trauma turns into her becoming overnight very famous, this like celebrity journalist. That is already, I think, like kind of a fun joke about the media's obsession with like trauma pieces and trauma ideology and trauma characters. But the film takes it really farther by having Deutsch, who is just this great young actress. I've admired her in almost everything she's done. You know, continue to keep playing this character as being super shallow, very vapid, no empathy at all for what she's supposedly gone through. And everybody around her just interprets that as her being, you know, in very deep, 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 deep shock. And this part of the farce is really funny, but one of the things that Quinn Shepherd does that I think is smart is she balances it out by including a character who is a genuinely traumatized teenager. Her name is Rowan, and she survived this high school shooting. And after that, she's become this like outspoken crusader against the NRA. And these two characters meet and form this kind of bond. And Rowan is really this person that Danny, you know, the journalist, wants to be. You know, she's brave and she's talented and she's vulnerable and she's very, very social media famous. And the actor who plays her, Mia Isaac, is just this young new actress that I really, really love. She was in a film that called Don't Make Me Go that just played a few weeks ago. She's marvelous. And I think she winds up really proving the point of this film, that like authenticity is the most compelling part of any story. So I thought this film, it has some flaws, but it's overall very, very fun and very, very sharp.
Sounds like it owes something to Dear Evan Hansen. You can see Not Okay on Hulu. The film is rated R. Next, A Love Song. It's a romance written and directed by Max Walker Silverman, who is making his feature directorial debut. The film stars Dale Dickey and Wes Studi. Claudia.
This is a very gentle, low-key, humanistic tale told with a lot of subtlety and grace. And perhaps most of all, it's a really wonderful showcase for two amazing, underrated actors, Dale Dickey and Wes Studi. The cinematography is quite stunning. It doesn't give you a lot of answers or backstories to these characters, but that's okay because it's really just a snapshot of a person living an unusual life without delving into the whys and, you know, wherefores and what happened to get them there. It's tender and lyrical and pensive, and it basically looks at solitude and companionship. I wouldn't call it like a fully realized love story, but like a love song. It's sort of the connection between two characters that is ephemeral. And I think Max Walker Silverman did a really nice job. It's a cliche to say that movies are love letters to a place, but this does feel like an ode to the American West, which I think is where he lives in Colorado. It's set in Colorado. You can tell it was made on a very low budget, and that suits the subject matter too. Basically, it's about a 60-ish woman camping in a remote area near a lake. She's living very simply and self-sufficiently, and she's waiting for an old high school flame to join her. And so for a lot of it, we're wondering, you know, is he going to come? She's wondering if he's going to come. And then at times when we meet some of the people who are camping around her, it kind of put me in mind of Nomadland. But we, you know, we learned that the movie is really about, it's about love, it's about commitment, it's about grief. I think it works really well. And I love to see Dale Dickey and Wes Studi. There's some moments when it's really tight close-ups on her face, which is this very weathered face. And it's kind of a beautiful thing to see because we don't see women of any age with wrinkles on the screen in Hollywood. And so that's a really quite stunning thing to see, this constellation of wrinkles on her face. It's a moving film.
Amy, what about your thoughts?
Yeah, there's this very tiny arc right at the beginning of it because you're introduced to Dale Dickey's character first where you're like, man, she is living like the loner's ideal pandemic life in Colorado. You know, she's camping out in this RV by a lake. Every day she just wakes up, she catches a lobster from the lake, she drinks a beer, she lights cherry bombs, and she goes to bed. And she has no sense of the day. She kind of picks her days out randomly from a calendar. It sneaks up on you that she's a little bit lonely. You know, you see it in the way that she tucks her hair behind her ears when she hears like vans approach, you know, that she's like waiting for somebody to knock on the door. She wants to look nice when it happens. And yeah, like what Claudia was saying, you're almost wondering if it's like waiting for Godot. Like, is this love of hers ever going to show up? And when, you know, he does, and when he's Wes Studi, they do have this like nice chemistry. And it's interesting to see them as romantic leads. Like, both of these actors have been on screen forever, and neither one of them has ever had an on-screen kiss before, which does feel like a waste. And it's one of the things I thought was a little strange is like the film kind of can't keep a handle on its tone exactly. Some of the characters that show up on the camp are really naturalistic. Others feel like they just walked right out of a Coen Brothers film. And I'm not sure like which movie he really wants to tell. I wouldn't mind if he went a little more Coen with it or if he went a little less. I just felt like you couldn't do half Coen and half not. But in any case, it's just like a pleasant film to hang out with for a while.
The movie is called The Love Song. It's rated PG, and it's playing at multiple AMC locations. Next up, Skies of Lebanon. It's a French drama that's partially animated and directed by Chloé Matzlou, making her feature directorial debut, who also co-wrote the film alongside Yacine Badet. The film stars Alba Rawaher and Wajdi Mouad. Claudia.
I thought that Chloé Matzlou did a lovely job here. This is a clever and also moving film. It has a stylized blend of animation, both, I think, hand-drawn and stop-motion. Charles can correct me on that one. It has a very vivid production design. And it's also, you know, trying to make a point about the horrors and irrationality of war, but it does this in a very, kind of a surrealistic way, almost, feeling theatrical at certain moments. But it basically follows these two people. I'm sorry, the pronunciation, Alba Rohrwacher and Wajdi Mouad, and their love story, and they have a lovely chemistry. At first, their life is really beautiful. And, you know, their extended family is delightful. They're in this very cosmopolitan city, Beirut. And, you know, they have this, they're all very cultured and, you know, educated and interesting. And then, of course, the war, which is depicted in a really interesting way. It's these two warring factions standing on the corner like street gangs. And then there's sandbags and there's people in costumes. And then I'm not sure what I think of that. It feels a little lighthearted and glib when you're talking about war, but it's, you know, I think ultimately the intentions of this film and the open-heartedness will out. And I thought that two lead actors, Alba and Wajdi, were both so good. He was the playwright of Incendie, which I thought was a fantastic film way back.
Directed by Denis Villeneuve.
Yes, yes, indeed. And I really liked this. I felt like it, you know, it got the message across in a very kind of micro and macro way, this, you know, how the war affected this family, this couple, and then also, of course, how it affected Lebanon.
Charles, your take.
Well, Claudia's correct. There are two animated sequences, I think. There's a stop motion sequence of Alice being trained to become a nanny by nuns in Switzerland. That was a lot cheaper than shooting in Switzerland or building that set. And at one point you see one of her drawings animate of a building collapsing. I found the film a bit limp, that everybody is so nice and so caring and so warm and so together that they're not terribly interesting. When all his relatives move in with them, when the war starts to escalate, nobody's bothered. Nobody minds. There are no conflicts except when the daughter of the main couple wants to join the love of her life in Paris after he's left. I don't think the stylized depictions of the war work. It might work on stage, but on film, to have characters in feather boas and skull masks kind of making very stylized movements against each other doesn't mesh with the terror we're supposed to be feeling for these people and the horror and sorrow of witnessing the destruction of their city. So I think it's well-intended and probably an interesting first film, but it didn't win me over the way it did Claudia.
The film is called Skies of Lebanon. It's unrated and playing at the Lemley Royal in West LA. The film is in French, Italian, and Arabic with subtitles. We're going to pick up the pace a little bit because we have a few more movies to get to. Next up, Resurrection. It's the feel-good parenting drama, except for the feel-good part. It stars Rebecca Hall and Tim Roth. The film is written and directed by Andrew Siemens. Amy, what do you have to say about this not-so-feel-good movie?
Yeah, that's an understatement. This film is based on a very sick premise that I kind of want to leave for people to watch it. Rebecca Hall is really our most prestigious actor who seems to say yes to every single small thriller, and she always shows up and plays it like it's an Oscar movie. And this one starts off like a lot of the Rebecca Hall thrillers. You know, she plays one of those overachievers. She keeps her life all tidy. She gives good advice. She jogs. She's healthy. She has her love life very neatly quarantined to this married booty call. And she has an 18-year-old daughter that she parents. And she's obsessed with looking strong, or at least, you know, not weak. And all of this world comes tumbling down when she sees Tim Roth from across the room. And she just goes into this complete panic attack. And I don't kind of want to say why, because to me, the only really tremendous part of this movie is this monologue that Rebecca Hall delivers, where it's this long one take with a tear, and she explains
it's
exactly
12 minutes,
what happens.
It's 12 minutes long. I watched the film twice. The take is 12 minutes long.
I mean, that's why you hire Rebecca Hall for a film like that, because when you have that scene, you're like, okay, the fact that none of this else really makes a ton of sense and I don't care about it, I forgive it for that one monologue. So I'm not that much interested in how the film played out, but I do think the really interesting dynamic in the movie is that when you realize that her idea of protecting her daughter from the things that have happened to her in the past makes her become an abuser, that there's sort of a cycle of abuse happening. And that was interesting, but I felt like the film really fell apart.
Claudia, your take on this movie?
Well, I agree with both of you about the 12-minute monologue. I thought that was the highlight of the movie. And I love Rebecca Hall. I think she's massively talented, both as an actor and a director. Her directorial debut last year with Passing was great. She's in a film. I'll watch it just because she's in it. And Tim Roth is also pretty great. But I felt like this story was really disappointingly uneven. Yes, she has her life all together. And yes, you know, she pretty much falls apart when Tim Roth kind of appears on the scene with one of the creepiest smiles I have ever seen. The way he bares his teeth in his smile. I was watching it with my husband and we both like out loud went, ew, it was just so awful. It's unnerving, but I didn't really buy it in the end. I thought it just went off the rails completely. I'm not going to say much more, but I do think that 12-minute monologue was great. And it's about trauma and sort of the lasting effects of trauma. And of course, she gives a really dimensional performance. She's both steely and unstable, sometimes in the same breath. So I really, really appreciated that.
Resurrection is playing at select Lemley theaters in the Alamo Drafthouse in downtown LA. The film will also be available on digital and video on demand beginning August 5th. It is unrated. We have a couple of minutes now for the biography drama 13 Lives. It's based on the real life rescue mission to save 12 young soccer players and their coach who get stuck in an underground cave in Thailand. The story was previously told in the 2021 documentary The Rescue, and there's also a 6-part Netflix miniseries with a grabby name, Thai Cave Rescue, coming in September. But back to the new film. It stars Colin Farrell, Viggo Mortensen, and Joel Edgerton. It's directed by Ron Howard, and William Nicholson wrote the screenplay. Claudia, your take on 13 Lives.
Well, I didn't know about the Netflix one, but there was also an action thriller called The Cave that came out, I think, in 2018. So this is an oft-told
There's probably
story.
A graphic novel and a podcast about it.
Right, right. I mean, understandably so. It is an inherently fascinating story, of course. And it's ideally suited to a film adaptation. I think the version that we see here, while it's generally well acted, lacks some suspense and some tautness in the direction. It's, of course, this harrowing true story. They focus a lot on, the three Save, the three people who come in to Save, which played by Colin Farrell, Joel Edgerton, and who's the third? Oh, of course, Viggo Mortensen. And they're great, but I wish I'd known more about the Thai person who actually was the only one to perish during this rescue attempt. He was also a Navy SEAL. I appreciate that Ron Howard had a lot of the film in Thai and that it, you know, there was a lot about the customs there, but there was a little bit of the white savior focus that kind of put me off, you know, by not looking deeply enough at the character of the Thai Navy SEAL named Saman. And I also felt the characters weren't really well developed. If you're going to focus on Viggo Mortensen and Colin Farrell and Joel Edgerton's characters, they should be better developed. And the rescue effort involved more than 5,000 people. It would have been good to see some of that coordinated effort. I understand that maybe cinematically he wanted to focus on those three, but it didn't fully work for me. I just felt it lacked some suspense and tautness and felt a little dry.
13 Lives is rated PG-13. It's playing at the AMC Grove in La Brea and streaming on Amazon Prime starting August 5th. We also did not get to DC League of Super Bets because of limited screenings. It stars Dwayne Johnson, keeping his new movie Every Other Friday streak intact. My thanks to critics Amy Nicholson, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. Coming up, my conversation with writer-director Jono MacLeod. We'll talk about his new film, My Old School. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle for Film Week when we come back.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to Film Week. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. In the mid-1990s, an unusual-looking student who called himself Brandon Lee appeared at the Bearsden Academy in Scotland. Unlike the other teenagers in his class, Lee looked much older and knew much more than his fellow students. And that's because Brandon Lee, not his real name, among many other falsehoods, wasn't a teenager. In fact, he was in his 30s. The documentary My Old School chronicles this odd tale of deception, what might have motivated, and how the ruse was unraveled. The director of the documentary is Jono MacLeod, who was a classmate of Lee's at the time. He put together a sort of cinematic high school reunion, talking to his fellow students at the time about their memories of Lee. Lee let MacLeod record an interview, but he would not appear on camera. So the director decided to hire actor Alan Cumming to essentially play Lee, sitting for an interview while lip-syncing Lee's recorded interview. And it turns out Cumming wasn't exactly a stranger to this strange story. Jono, thanks so much for coming in. I want to ask you, first of all, about a movie that wasn't made about this subject, because there was one that didn't happen. What is the story about the other movie?
Yeah, so that was a movie called Younger Than Springtime that was meant to be made in Scotland in the late 1990s. It was going to tell the story of Brandon, the Bearsden schoolboy, and it was going to be directed by and star Alan Cumming as Brandon. And when that film never happened, for whatever reason, we were all a bit stumped, myself and my classmates, you know, that we felt like the greatest high school movie had happened to us. Why was nobody making this film happen? And so as the kind of years and then decades went by and nobody had made it, we felt like maybe it was time that we kind of got the gang back together and had a go at telling the story ourselves.
Did that time away from the story help in terms of seeing it maybe more clearly or differently, having a different prism that time gave you?
No, but I think it influenced my film in the way that it clouded all our memories. The passage of time, what that meant was that the person who was telling the story over the years was Brandon himself. And that very much influenced certainly my understanding of the story. And it wasn't until I got the pupils and teachers back together to kind of actually hear from them rather than hear from the man himself for once, that we started to kind of find that things didn't quite tally with his version of events.
There is a huge amount of belief on the part of the students and the faculty at this school. They want to believe that everything is true, even though their eyes tell them differently. I'm going to play something from the beginning of the film. This is when Brandon first appears in a classroom.
I remember looking at him and thinking, oh, he looked like a man.
Funny hair, glasses, more stubble for some reason than your average pupil.
And they go on to talk about how they thought maybe he was a student teacher. I mean, he is, at this point, 32, passing for 16?
Yeah, the teachers told us that here was a 16-year-old boy from Canada. So he'd had some tragedy befall him in the recent past, and that's what had brought him to Bear's Den to be with us. So we had to be nice to him. And I think part of that being nice involved perhaps not asking too many questions and just kind of marvelling at what this new kid looked like. But then that, you know, our belief in him and our understanding of him was very much informed by American culture, really, because, you know, we grew up watching Beverly Hills 90210 or Grease, where 30-year-old actors played high school teens. So we thought that's what you guys looked like over here. And here was this North American had come to be with us. Of course he would look different. He would look older than us. That's what those guys looked like.
And Beverly Hills 90210 is not incidental, because that was part of where he found the name, Brandon Lee. He didn't know that Bruce Lee had a son named Brandon Lee who was killed in a movie set accident. Or did he?
Or did he? Yeah, I mean, the Beverly Hills thing is so fascinating, because Bear's Den, the town where I went to school, is very much the Beverly Hills of Glasgow. So there was real parallels with that, with the place, with the show. And yeah, Brandon was the perfect pupil, really. He presented as the ideal student that the teachers of Bear's Den Academy would want to have, much better than us.
Well, he was, I guess, too good to be true as a student. And I want to play a clip from the film where there's a conversation in class about Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller and Willie Loman.
Now, class, in this scene, Willie Loman tells his son Biff that the key to success in life is simply to be well-liked, to be popular. But what is Arthur Miller suggesting about Willie's state of mind?
He answered the question.
Well, miss, in Willie Loman's head, he doesn't see his son as a 34-year-old man. To him, Biff is a high school sophomore again. So Miller is implying a psychotic delusion, perhaps as an allegorical or metaphorical hallucination of chronology.
I mean, the hallucination of chronology is kind of an important little point here, given who the speaker is. But was he bluffing, or was he really smart? Did he understand a text like Death of a Salesman on a deeper level than most kids his presumed age would be?
So what we're hearing there is one of the flashback, the animated scenes that I have kind of scripted. So I've used a little bit of license there, but he very much did study Death of a Salesman. And I found myself seeing the London West End production of Death of a Salesman during the process of making this film. And there's this scene where Willie goes into this delusion and believes that Biff is back in high school again. I just thought, gosh, Brandon sat in class and studied that text with everyone and must have just felt so smug and so like and so superior to knowing that he was holding this secret. So I wanted to kind of play off that in the film. And just things, and there's another scene in physics class, you know, where he one of the students remembers that Brandon would get the teacher to try and define the concept of time. And you just think, what are you doing here, mate? You're really having fun with it at this point, I guess. Because once you're in safe, then that's when you can start to play with the toy soldiers, I guess.
When you are reuniting your classmates to make this movie, what is their interest in or concerns about revisiting this part of their life history?
I think for a lot of them, it was the overwhelming thing was a concern for Brandon, actually, and a fondness for him. And so once they knew that he had been interviewed and was part of the project in that sense, then they were more comfortable. But then they also went on the same journey that I did of finding out things along the way. And there's certain stuff that I found out about Brandon's time at school. There's some footage that we unearthed that we use in the film that certainly changed my perspective of some of the decisions that he made.
How so? This is footage of something that happens on the campus.
Yeah, basically, he takes the lead in the High School Musical, which is a bold move for any new student, let alone one who's pretending to be somebody else.
South Pacific is the show.
The musical is South Pacific, and he takes the lead, one of the lead roles of Lieutenant Cable, who sings the song, "Younger Than Springtime Am I." Basically... found this footage, and there's a moment in the film where people's memories are revealed to be not as they believe them to be. Basically my understanding in of the story changed over the 5 years that I was making it from beginning to end.
You're talking about how somebody's memory of something is challenged by this footage, but it also feels like other people's memory is challenged by what their classmates say, that they have adopted a view of what happened that is ingrained in their memory, even if it's not authentic or true. So a lot of the people who are speaking to you are having to deal with their own memories and their own assumptions and their own misinformation in a way.
Actually, I think some people's misinformation, some of the people I interviewed in the film, until they saw the film, they didn't know they were misinformed, because I didn't correct them during the interview process. I just let them tell me their a version of events that I knew to be wrong, because I knew that I wanted to play with that in the film, and to bounce between people's different recollections. So I think that's as much a theme of the film as anything, is like, yes, Brandon can't be trusted, but actually memory can't either.
Coming up, more of my conversation with director Jonna McLeod about his documentary, My Old School. It's Film Week on KPCC. Welcome back to Film Week. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Let's return to my conversation with director Jonna McLeod. His new documentary is called My Old School. Brandon's story probably evolves as well, and there's some archival interviews that you find and use, and then there's a contemporary interview that you use. Obviously, he is somebody who tells a lot of tall tales. Does the story about himself, after he is revealed, change as well?
I mean, yeah, in terms of his backstory, yeah, is absolutely different, and it does have something to say about... I mean, it's hard to make a film in the UK and not have it be about social class. And that's very much what this film ends up kind of delving into. Bearsden, the town where I went to school, is not the town where I'm from. And basically, kind of Margaret Thatcher almost is a kind of ghost from the past in this film, because in the 1980s, she brought in a law that allowed children like myself to choose a school out with their catchment area. But for Brandon, back in the day, that wasn't an option. And so the ability to climb through social class and to achieve and things was very different. Yeah, it's a real kind of study of the British class system, I think, in that aspect of the film. Albeit somebody who makes a really odd decision to try and get up the ladder.
What were your conversations like about getting Brandon to sit for an interview?
Just reached out. He's told his story multiple times over the years. He's published a few memoirs. He has, you know, as we see at the end of the film, he's done the chat show circuit in the past, and he's done multiple newspaper interviews. So there had been a number of filmmakers, as far as I'm aware, there was a number of filmmakers kind of sniffing around, looking to tell this story, because it's kind of known as one of Scotland's greatest hoax, I would say. So, you know, the approach came from me, and I was the only filmmaker of that bunch who was actually there. So I think that perhaps connected with him. But he had this line in the sand, you know, that he was willing to be interviewed, but he would not appear on camera this time around. So if I could think of a way to make my film without him having to appear, then I was welcome to. And I instantly thought of a film from about 12 years ago called The Arbor by Clio Bernard, a documentary that really successfully used lip sync with multiple actors throughout, But then I also knew that what I was seeking to do was to hang an entire film around one actor's performance and a lip sync. And yeah, who in a film about going back in time to reconnect with your former self, who better to play the role than the man who was meant to play this role back in the 1990s? And that's Alan Cumming. And also then I would then be safe in the hands of a fantastic actor.
So Alan Cumming, to explain it, is sitting for an interview, and while he is not audibly speaking, his lips are moving as Brandon is speaking on recorded tape. So there's no separation from Alan's mouth to Brandon's words. It looks like he is speaking them. But there are also moments where Alan is looking or thinking about something. So there is some, I don't know if it's directing or the way that you're filming Alan, that you're getting a little bit inside Brandon's mind, I think, by looking at how Alan is interpreting these events. Can you talk a little bit about how you use those moments where there wasn't narration, there wasn't part of the interview being replayed?
Yeah, that's just the genius of Alan's performance, I guess, in that, you know, I can see how someone might look at this film and go, oh, why did he not just have a little cartoon, older Brandon, speaking those words? And it's because that would have been two little dots for an eye and a moving mouth, and it wouldn't have been this captivating performance of a man sitting telling truths and untruths. And you know, that was what was interesting with filming with Alan, with directing Alan, was just the questions that he would ask. He would want to know, do you think he's lying at this point? And you'd see his performance change according to Mike, what I thought about that. But you know, for the most part, that Alan performance was a real lean back moment for me as a director, and actually kind of cute in a way, because Alan was meant to direct that movie back in the 90s, and the actual process of lip syncing with, it's like a reverse ADR where we'd, it's beep beep beep, do the line, beep beep beep, do the line again, and that would go on and on and on, and it was down to Alan to decide if he'd nailed it or not.
Wow.
Because we had so many to get through in quite a short shoot. And, you know, so it would just be occasionally we would step in and readjust something. But it was like some kind of Olympic acting performance, being in the room, seeing this incredibly gifted actor do this thing that, you know, as I say, while other films have done this before, I think we're the first film to use a name actor, basically, to use a big name and get them to kind of, it's sort of Little Mermaid style, give up their voice, give up the power of their voice that they normally use for their acting performance and inhabit someone else's. It's really fascinating.
It would probably be weird to watch this movie, then meet Alan and say, you don't sound anything like Brandon, because he becomes Brandon. I was looking briefly at some reviews, and some people felt very judgmental about Brandon. I didn't come away with that. Some people thought he was kind of, you know, narcissistic and used people. I think other people, including me, feel somewhat sad for him and realize that he was trying to fill a void that he couldn't fill otherwise. Is that part of the intention of the film, that people can come away and not judge Brandon, but have different takes on his motivations and the kind of person he was? Do you have a feeling of how people should feel about him?
No, and I get that. Actually, I don't tie things up in a bow at the end of this film, but I have in doing the rounds and doing the screenings and doing the press for the film, I've encountered people who I've clearly infuriated because I've not made their mind up for them, and I find that wild. Like, I can't get my head around it, that people want me to tell them what to think about this. Like, that all I wanted to do was kind of tell a story and leave. I wanted people to leave the cinema talking about it. And if I tied it all up in a bow and told you exactly what I think you should think, A, I shouldn't be doing that, I don't think. And B, it's much more fun to go get a beer after and talk about it.
There's a character who says near the end of the film, you can follow your dreams without deceiving people. And I think part of the story is, what is your dream? Who defines your dream? Is it a dream that you think you feel compelled to fill inside yourself, or a dream that you think society expects of you? And how you measure, is your dream a dream or is it a measurement of success? And that seems almost to be the glue that holds this whole story together.
It feels like the glue that holds that whole town together, to be honest with you. You know, it kind of infuses that place. The team back in the UK were like, "Hey, Jono, we're thinking of doing a screening of the film in Bear's Den. Are you up for that?" And I was like, "Hell no. I don't know that I'll be setting foot willingly in that town anytime soon because I feel like I've slightly punctured it." But, you know, that's what needed to be done to tell this story.
Jono MacLeod is the writer and director of My Old School, also an alumnus of My Old School. Jono, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, John.
That was director Jono MacLeod talking about his documentary, My Old School. It's showing at the Monica Film Center and Lemley NoHo in North Hollywood. It's unrated. And that's going to do it for Film Week. Thanks for listening. I'm John Horn. I'll be back next week, too, while Larry Mantle is away. Have a great weekend.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.